Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today graduated from UC Berkeley, worked as a newspaper reporter and editor for 27 years at the Los Angeles Times, the Oakland Tribune, and the Associated Press and United Press International Bureaus in San Francisco. Jack Cheevers won a 2014 award for naval literature for his first book, Act of War, Lyndon Johnson, North Korea, and the Capture of the Spy Ship Pueblo. He then spent 10 years researching and writing a definitive history of one of the most catastrophic decisions ever made by a U.S. president. I'm going to ask Jack Cheevers about this book, Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. Jack Cheevers, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Well, now, I understand that you walked into a California coffee shop one day and you picked up this worn-out paper book, and that inspired you to write that first book. Is that true?
That's exactly what happened. I was living at the time in Venice, California, down south. And there was a great coffee shop in my neighborhood that had used books for sale for a buck a piece. So I would go down there on the weekends and rummage around and see what my doll would buy me that weekend. And I came across the ghostwritten autobiography of by the captain of the USS Pueblo, a man by the name of Lloyd Bucher. And I brought the book home. I figured I'd just read a couple pages, you know, that Saturday, and then do whatever I was going to do. And I just found myself mesmerized by the book. And I read the whole thing in a weekend, and decided that I wanted to write that story. There are other dimensions to it that the captain hadn't gotten to in his autobiography, such as, you know, how the Johnson administration negotiated the release of the crew from North Korea, some of the tensions that were taking place at the time on the Korean Peninsula, and how close the Johnson administration came to actually going, you know, attacking North Korea to try and get the crew back. But yeah, that's exactly how that book got kicked off.
Well, there is a local writer here in Chico, Commander David Brune. He is retired from the Navy, and he has written a lot of books on naval history, and one of them was about the Pueblo, this capture of the Pueblo. And he also, there was a reunion, the last get-together of the survivors of the Pueblo. He actually attended that get-together. So there are survivors of the Pueblo that you could have interviewed for that book, but also I was so impressed with the research you did for this book that I want to ask you about today, Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. And the amount of research you did was so impressive. Oh, my goodness. And I just think it's hard. I can't imagine anybody reading your book without being shocked, without thinking, oh, my gosh, I had no idea. Do you get that reaction to people who read your book?
Well, the book's only been out for a little while.
Yes,
so
it is new.
So it came out in mid-February. So it's just now getting into circulation in libraries and bookstores and so forth. There's been a few reviews on Amazon, for instance, and Goodreads.com, where one guy said, you know, I learned something new in every chapter of this book.
Oh, so, yeah.
I think that, I mean, this coup has been written about before, but it's you know, it's often included in you know, wider scope histories of Vietnam, but it's kind of written about in passing almost. You know, it might mm-hmm. take up a couple of pages in a longer book on history in the Vietnam War, but I decided that after looking into it and doing some initial spade work and some initial research, that it was just a fascinating story unto itself. And so I decided to devote a whole book to it and really get into the details of it. That's been something I've been, you know, that's kind of a hallmark of my career as a writer. I always want to get to the bottom of the story.
Well, you certainly have a lot of research in the book, and close to 700 pages, but I couldn't put it down. And you'd think that 700 pages would be a lot to read, but you had eyewitness interviews, you had documents from the Freedom of Information request that you did. So that was quite impressive. But also, as I started reading it, I'm thinking, okay, I need a map of this part of the world. And you do have a map of Saigon. But I was looking at that and thinking, I wonder how much of the history of this part of the world do people know typically? For example, do they know what French Indochina was?
Right, yeah. The roots of the story go way, way back. I mean, you know, Vietnam, it goes, I don't know how many centuries back it goes. I mean, Vietnam was occupied for 1,000 years by the Chinese before it was occupied for a century by the French. So it has a long, long history, certainly. And the roots of the coup itself go back, decades and decades. So it's... Unfortunately, publishers don't like maps because they're expensive. You have to pay an artist, and then you have to do special paper. And, yeah. I finally talked my editor into running a map of Saigon, so at least people can track the movements of the primary characters in the coup story.
Yeah, I was looking at that map. Just about every page I turned, I would flip back to the map. So thank you for talking your publisher into that. Well, let's start at the very beginning. Chapter one. Would you read a little bit of chapter one? Now, when we start reading, the first thing we do is meet this character. We don't know who he is. We don't know maybe where he is, if people don't know this town that or this city that you mentioned. So forgive me if I interrupt you for a little bit to give you a chance to explain some of what you're reading. So would you start there on that first page, Jack?
So this is page one. This is the very beginning of the book. John Helbley loved to drift along the Perfume River at night. For practically nothing, he could rent a sampan, and a Vietnamese boatman would steer him out into the middle of the wide, slow-moving stream. From there, the low outlines of the old imperial capital of Hue were faintly visible along both banks, north and south. Helbley floated on the calm black water in near silence, past places where long ago emperors marshaled armies, wrote poetry, and frolicked with concubines. Dim lights shone from both shores, but there was little traffic noise, for in 1963, few people in Hue drove after dark. Helbley, the 29-year-old American consul in Hue, had many visitors from Saigon, often fellow State Department officers and their wives. They came north ostensibly on official business, but really to tour the citadel, the unimaginably luxurious home of the Nguyen emperors, in the overgrown but still magnificent imperial tombs nearby. Helbley's entertainment program usually included a nighttime sampan outing on the Perfume. He and his guests glided up and down the river, no particular destination in mind, as smaller canoe-like vessels, their prows lit by lanterns, pulled alongside, offering Vietnamese delicacies cooked on the spot.
Can I interrupt you for just a second, Jack? You mentioned they came north ostensibly on official business. So these people from the State Department were coming north from, you might kind of tell us the relationship between Hue and Saigon.
Sure. Well, Saigon was the capital of South Vietnam, as I'm sure most people know. Hue was about 400 miles north. It was a beautiful old city. As I mentioned, it was the imperial capital. That's where the emperors had their palaces and so forth for many centuries. And it was a very quiet city. The river cut through right through the middle of it. There was very little crime. There's very little nightlife. It was it's also the capital of Buddhism in South Vietnam. Buddhism plays a big factor in the story later on. And John Helbley was the U.S. consul up there. He basically functioned as a one-man observation post for the uppermost, the northernmost provinces of South Vietnam. And he reported directly to the U.S. embassy in Saigon.
And he was only 29, so he was young enough that he could have left information about his role. So would you continue then about these Vietnamese delicacies cooked on the spot?
Sure. Yeah, there were various stories about how the Perfume got its name, but the best one was that it had been scented by orchids falling into its waters far upstream in the foothills of the Annamite Mountains. Helbley would always remember the languorous beauty of those quiet nights on the Perfume River, but when he arrived on its south bank one hot day in May 1963, he wasn't playing tour guide, he was investigating a massacre. With its French doors and colorful border of tropical flowers, the South Vietnamese government radio station next to the river seemed an unlikely spot for bloodshed. But on the manic night of May 8, 1963, several thousand Hue residents, most of them Buddhists, had surrounded the station, demanding that it devote airtime to a commemoration of Buddha's birthday. The station manager refused, and soldiers and militiamen moved in with rifles, concussion grenades, and armored vehicles. Gunfire erupted, along with violent explosions. The terrified crowd fled in all directions, leaving behind seven lifeless bodies. An eighth person died later. And so this is meant to introduce not only John Helbley, but the one of the real seeds of the coup against Ngo Dinh Diem, which was an uprising by Buddhists across the country.
Excuse me, would you repeat that name that you just said? Because you haven't mentioned him. So would you explain or say that name again, please?
Sure. Ngo Dinh Diem, and he at the time was the president of South Vietnam, pretty authoritarian. He'd been in power since 1954 and had a great deal of U.S. support, military and economic support.
So this is the character that you introduced at the very beginning and where he is. Now, you just mentioned another character, but is it kind of the situation of John Kennedy consulted his brother Robert, and his brother Robert played a large role in the decisions he made? Was that kind of the case with the two brothers there in South Vietnam?
It was. And Bobby Kennedy was John Kennedy's younger brother. He was the U.S. Attorney General at the time. And he really had his hands full with civil rights and trying to desegregate some of the southern universities. But they were very, very close. Bobby was John Kennedy's closest political confidant, his closest political advisor. John Kennedy took Bobby's advice very, very seriously. And as the Vietnam situation heated up, John started inviting Bobby to attend White House meetings where Vietnam was being discussed. So especially as the coup sort of hurtled to a denouement in the fall of 1963, Bobby was at every meeting and was pretty vocal in his opinions.
Well, this was chapter one, and you mentioned these two brothers pretty much together rule the country, but then his sister-in-law. I found her interesting because she was one of South Vietnam's most despised figures, because there were characters in your book that I adored and admired. She was not one of them. Who was this madam?
Well, Diem had a younger brother named Nu, Ngo Dinh Nu, N-H-U. And they had a relationship very similar to the Kennedy brothers. Ngo was very close to his older brother, Diem. Ngo was Diem's closest political advisor. He had a huge role in running the South Vietnamese government. He was the head of the secret police. He was head of a very secret political party that supported his brother, called the Khan Lao Party. He ran an organization called the Republican Youth, which was essentially a paramilitary army that Diem and Nu were organizing in the countryside among young men and young women to support their government. And Nu's wife was a woman by the name for shorthand, was Madame Nu. And she was notorious for her very, very sharp tongue. She was also very powerful in her own right. She was a member of the National Assembly. She ran her own all-female paramilitary army, and she didn't hesitate to publicly excoriate people in Diem's government who she didn't like, people in the army, American diplomats, American journalists, She was famous for her sharp tongue. And she was also the subject of all sorts of scurrilous rumors that she was robbing the South Vietnam vine, that she was having sex with Diem, which was not the case, was never the case. He was unmarried and very, very much a single man. But she became a notorious figure in South Vietnam.
It got to be kind of funny, actually, because here's Jack Kennedy, and the Americans are saying, we got to get her out of there. But Jack Kennedy, JFK did not want her coming to the United States because she was disliked everywhere. My guest is Jack Cheevers, and his book is Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Jack Cheevers, whose book is Kennedy's Coup. One of my favorite chapters was Chapter 5 about the journalist. And I think maybe, well, you were a journalist yourself, but the journalists, in my reading of are the heroes in your book, Jack. Am I accurate in feeling like, gosh, those journalists, they're the heroes in this story.
Well, you know, they are among my personal heroes, but I was trying not to let that show too much in the book. I was trying to portray them, you know, warts and all. But I think that they did really a terrific job in South Vietnam in terms of covering a very, very complex story and doing it in very dangerous circumstances. And there were just a handful of American journalists in Saigon in the early 60s who worked there full time. And it wasn't a story that was, you know, really on the public radar in the United States. And these guys were all very young. They were in their mid-20s, late 20s. And the most prominent figure there was a New York Times reporter named David Halberstam, who later...
And that's a name I knew. I was familiar with him. So, excuse me for interrupting, but why don't you read the first part of Chapter 5, if you would, where you introduce us to David Halberstam.
Okay. Well, this is Halberstam arriving in Saigon for the first time in the fall of 1962. This is about a year before the coup took place. As he stepped off his plane at Tan Son Nhut Airport, David Halberstam was convinced he'd been delivered to South Vietnam as surely by fate as by jetliner. At 28, Halberstam was a rising star at America's most influential newspaper, the New York Times. Boisterous, opinionated, and boyishly extroverted, he quickly established himself as the dominant personality in the small but talented group of American news reporters stationed in Saigon. The rangy Harvard graduate made no bones about his prodigious ego, joking to friends about an editor's remark that, quote, David is almost as good a reporter as he thinks he is, close quote. He could reduce noisy restaurants and cocktail parties to stunned silence with booming denunciations of government officials, his fist slamming the table for emphasis. With his thick-framed glasses, caterpillar eyebrows, and big grin, he was a brilliant brat, as vocally combative with his New York bosses as he was with dissembling bureaucrats. Halberstam would soon be haunting the U.S. Embassy, buttonholing anyone and everyone for news leads and traveling widely in the countryside, talking with American advisors who saw the war at mud level. It was easy to take sides for or against Diem when Halberstam arrived in Saigon in September 1962.
Excuse me for just a second, because the name that you're saying, people may wonder, what's that name he's saying? It's actually spelled D-I-E-M, this character that you just read that sentence. It was easy to take sides for or against this character whose name is D-I-E-M. Okay, excuse
right,
me, continue.
Yeah. And again, that's Ngo Dinh Diem. He's the president of South Vietnam at this time. Many Americans there, both military and civilian, had quietly turned against the president, believing his government was too weak and unpopular to win the war and too repressive to deserve U.S. support. Others thought the tough, experienced Diem was the only person who could hold his people and army together against the Viet Cong. Viet Cong is the communist insurgents who are becoming a more and more serious problem to Diem's government every day. Halberstam soon joined the critics' ranks, setting himself against not only Diem, but against Nolting and Harkins as well. Nolting and Harkins, respectively, are the U.S. ambassador at the time, Frederick Nolting, and General Harkins, who was the head of the the American military mission to South Vietnam. Passionate about digging up hard truths, the young Times man developed a deep and enduring anger toward both U.S. officials, seeing them as part of what he called, quote, the lying machine that was trying to whitewash the difficulties Americans were encountering in the war.
Excuse me again, Jack, but that last sentence, the lying machine that was trying to whitewash the difficulties Americans were encountering in the war. And that's where the journalists, I think, are heroes, because they didn't put up with that. Excuse me.
Right. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. While most other Saigon journalists aimed to be neutral observers, Halberstam harbored a crusader zeal. Quote, he was quite different from the rest of us, said his friend Horst Foss, a photographer for the Associated Press News Service. Quote, he believed in his duty to change things. Halberstam's judgment about people and events could be savagely harsh, yet he had a sophisticated grasp of both politics and military strategy, and his Saigon Dateline stories would boldly contradict Washington's official optimism about the war in a manner that had little precedent in American journalism. Before his 15-month stint in South Vietnam was over, he'd be vilified as soft on communism, a weak sister who cried at the sight of dead Viet Cong, and a conscious subverter of American foreign policy. An irritated JFK would try to get him yanked out of South Vietnam. But the torrent of insightful front page news stories and Sunday analysis pieces that rushed from Halberstam's battered portable typewriter would create a remarkably full and vivid portrait of the Diem regime and earn their author a Pulitzer Prize.
I remind readers that my guest is Jack Cheevers. He's reading from his book, Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. Now, you also, a couple of pages after what you were just reading, tell us what Halberstam discovered when he actually tramped with the troops. He actually got out there with them, and he could see what the situation was. Do you remember what he says he learned that first day on the Delta?
He just started to understand the difficulties of fighting a counterinsurgency war. And he developed a mentor there by a U.S. Army lieutenant colonel by the name of John Paul Vann, V-A-N-N. And Vann was stationed in the Mekong Delta region with a South Vietnamese Army division. And he had been there for a number of months, and he could see the weaknesses in the South Vietnamese Army, as well as the strength in the Viet Cong insurgents. And in 1962, when Halberstam arrived, Kennedy had started had launched a massive program of military aid to South Vietnam, and had sent in all sorts of, you know, the most modern U.S. warfighting technology, like helicopters, armored personnel carriers, napalm, tanks, automatic rifles, all sorts of things like that. But even with all that up-to-the-date technology, the South Vietnamese Army didn't seem able to do much against the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong were very clever at hit-and-run attacks. They were very good at organizing local villagers to fight the army whenever the army came close. And they were just growing strong. You know, their units were getting bigger all the time. They were recruiting more and more peasants who were alienated by what the South Vietnamese army was doing to them. And they're just becoming a more dangerous and potent army over time.
And these were problems that could not be seen from the air. And so people in the position of making decisions didn't have the same picture that somebody like Halberstam had, where he could see how hard it was to pursue guerrillas in on this ground. And then the other thing, too, was the poor peasants in the villages and how the war was affecting them. So this is what Halberstam witnessed by actually being there. And he realized that he couldn't trust U.S. officials.
Yeah, and he was, you know, he was a young guy. He was 28 years old. He was very energetic. And he would go out into the field whenever he could with American combat advisors who were attached to South Vietnamese army units. And he would see, you know, the war literally, you know, up close and personal, and see the, you know, how these battles were fought, see, you know, the shortcomings of the South Vietnamese, see how the Viet Cong were able to fight off much larger South Vietnamese army units, despite all the assistance they were getting from American helicopters and armored personnel carriers and all, and that sort of thing.
So you make the point that the worst weapon was an airplane. The best weapon for killing people was a knife. And this just, people did not, in the position to make decisions, were not in that position to know, to have this information.
Yeah, and I think that was a big problem. I think that was a problem the Americans encountered throughout the war, was that, you know, we were relying on technology too much. And when you use aircraft to bomb people, invariably, you're going to kill innocents. And the people who, you know, are the loved ones who survive, the dead innocents, are going to be prime recruits for the enemy army. When you use a weapon like napalm, it's very difficult. It's a horrible weapon. You're burning people to death. And, you know, you do that enough
times. So you might mention why they thought they needed napalm to begin with. Why did they think they needed that?
How to describe it? It's jellied gasoline. It's dropped in the form of a bomb, and it explodes and blows, you know, pieces of flaming jelly gasoline all over the place. And so if you're anywhere near this thing, you're burned to death. And the way it killed people was by sucking all the oxygen out of the area. So either you suffocated to death or you were burned to death. And it's a hideous weapon. And, you know, you're dropping this from the air. These are not precision weapons at all. And lots of people, you know, who were non-combatants were getting killed by these things. And that was generating a lot of resentment among the surviving villagers.
Well, now you just used the word burning, and we can't ignore something that we in the United States did learn about. And that's the Buddhist who set fire to himself. So what was the situation then? You did mention the Buddhist before. Why was that a problem?
Well, the Ziem and his family were all Catholics, and they were very ardent Catholics. One of his brothers was actually the Catholic Archbishop of Hue. They were very flamboyant in their practice of Catholicism. They went to church all the time, and they held Catholic celebrations in the big cities in South Vietnam and so forth. And the South Vietnam at the time was a Buddhist majority country. About 70% of the population was at least nominally Buddhist. And the Buddhists had long resented Catholic influence in the government and the army. They felt that the preference was given to Catholics in terms of getting jobs, in terms of getting promotions. They felt that the Catholic Church was being advantaged over them in terms of acquiring land for churches, and they had difficulties building their pagodas at the same time. So there was a lot of resentment building up, and had been going on for a long time between the Buddhists and the Catholics. Catholics only constituted about 10 or 12% of the population, but they were, you know, they were in control of the palace, and a Catholic was president. The thing that kind of triggered what became known as the Buddhist crisis was an incident that took place in Hue in May of 1963. That's the massacre that I referred to earlier that John Helbley investigated. And what happened was that the Buddhists went to the radio station to protest, and Diem's government security forces showed up with rifles and armored vehicles and so forth, and wound up killing 8 people. And the Buddhists were furious over that. And that triggered a nationwide protest movement against the Diem government. And the next incident that happened was, took place in June 1963, where a Buddhist monk, an elderly monk, sat down in the middle of an intersection in Saigon. Gasoline was poured over him, and he set himself on fire and burned to death. There was a reporter there named Malcolm Brown from the Associated Press who happened to have his camera with him that day, and he took a series of pictures. I'm sure a lot of people have seen this picture. It's become one of the most famous news photographs of all time, the burning monk. And that picture was printed in newspapers and magazines around the world. Kennedy had a copy of it on his desk in the Oval Office. The protest movement, it started to really damage Diem's reputation in the United States. He started to be portrayed as a religious bigot. And, you know, people were wondering, they would see this photograph of this old man on fire, this old monk on fire, and think, you know, Diem must be the worst person in the world. Why would anybody be setting themselves on fire to protest a guy unless he was the most horrible, oppressive ruler imaginable? And Diem really wasn't that. I mean, he was an ardent Catholic, but he understood that he was president of, you know, all of South Vietnamese. In fact, his government had given financial support to the Buddhists in the past to build schools and pagodas and so forth. But a lot of Buddhists were very wary of him. Some of the more extreme people thought that Diem was actually trying to establish Catholicism as a state religion and eradicate Buddhism. As that crisis deepened, and as the protests multiplied in Vietnam, it made it more difficult for Kennedy to support Diem, because he was now being criticized for enabling this horrible, oppressive, you know, religious bigot, you know, 10,000 miles away. And why was the U.S. giving all this economic and military support to such an oppressive, authoritarian ruler?
After a break, Jack Cheevers and I will continue our conversation about the Vietnam War. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Jack Cheevers, who has researched the Vietnam War and written a book, Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. I mentioned that a murder, the monk set himself on fire, but we haven't gotten to a murder. How did that come about?
Well, that's a reference to the fact that ZM and his brother Nu were murdered during the coup in November of 1963.
Well, there's so much misinformation. I remember one place where General Harkins declared victory at this battle, and the journalist couldn't believe he was declaring victory. They saw what the truth was. And then you mentioned Van before, and one quote from him, a miserable performance, and he gave a list of all the problems of these forces and that American public was not getting the facts. And so here's, we have a president trying to make decisions, and he's not getting accurate information. One thing about Kennedy, too, is that he didn't stick, he happened to be Democrat, but he didn't only select people, advisors, if you want to call them that, who were Democrats. And so that's something that I think, okay, so Kennedy was willing to listen to people who may not have agreed with him.
Right. And I think, you know, I think that's a problem that presidents always face during times of crisis, especially during wartime, is getting accurate information. And, you know, the military, the Pentagon, Paul Harkins in Saigon would say one thing, and then the State Department and the CIA would say something completely different. And you know, Kennedy actually complained about that to his advisors at one point, said, you know, how can we run a policy if we can't even agree on the same set of facts? And he sent you know, his personal emissaries to South Vietnam to try and get good information, to try and understand what was really happening there. And people kept coming back with these contradictory reports. And I can only imagine how frustrating that must have been for him. But it's also, it's like you said, you know, if you can't understand what's really happening on the ground, it's very, very difficult to make an effective policy, a workable policy.
Well, you know, something that I did not know, we all knew when Nixon was recording conversations that he had a recorder on, but I did not know that when people came in and sat down with Kennedy, he would flip a switch and record the meetings that he had. This is John Kennedy, Jack Kennedy.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, Nancy, because I didn't know that either before I started the research.
So I'm not the only one.
No, not at all. But the good news is that you can go onto the website for the Kennedy Presidential Library, and all the tapes are, I don't know if all of them, but many, many of these tapes have been made public, and you can listen to them on your laptop. And they're fascinating. Because they take you into, you know, the Oval Office. They take you into the cabinet room as Kennedy and his advisors are debating all sorts of issues. Vietnam is one of them, but, you know, the civil rights, there's all sorts of things going on with the Soviet Union. And it's really fascinating to listen to these conversations. And the problem for me as a writer is that Kennedy used to bring all kinds of people into the room. And people would, you know, start talking over each other. And some people would be kind of, you know, some people would be close to the microphone, some people would be far away from the microphone. And I got to the point where I listened to enough of these and I listened to them for enough hours that I could actually distinguish between people's voices. I could tell you when, you know, McNamara was talking or Bobby Kennedy was talking, Dean Rusk and so forth. But it took me forever to try and transcribe these things, because especially because of that phenomenon of people talking over each other.
Well, there are.
I mean, I would have to run these tapes. I mean, I would have to listen to one, you know, a 10-second segment of the tape like 20 times before I could really be, you know, feel, you know, certain that I'd gotten the words down correctly.
Well, reading your book was an emotional ride for me, because sometimes I would be mad, sometimes I would be sad, and sometimes I would laugh. And for example, here's this 71-year-old Harriman who would just turn off his hearing aids when he was in a meeting. If he didn't want to listen, he could turn off his hearing aids. And Kennedy called Harriman a crocodile. And how did he, what did Kennedy have on his desk?
Well, you're talking about Averell Harriman.
Yes,
who was,
yes.
The Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the time. And he was quite a character. He was a very wealthy businessman. He had been the Democratic governor of New York. He had been involved in with FDR and Churchill and Stalin during World War II. He was very experienced. He was an excellent negotiator. But he was this kind of this towering personality, and you know he didn't suffer fools, and he got a reputation for just interrogating his aides. He'd bring them in early in the morning and just start firing questions at them one after another, and if they in any way faltered, he'd take their heads off. And so, I mean, metaphorically speaking. So, anyways, he got this reputation as a crocodile, and somebody gave him a little brass model of a crocodile, which he proudly kept on his desk. He thought that was a mark of great distinction.
Well, it was rather impressive, JFK's flock of bright men, as you refer to them as. So he had good, well, he had the best sources that he could get of information, but it's just the Halberstam, for example, wrote a letter about stonewalling, and the information that was not accurate that was being provided. And you say that JFK wanted troops out of Vietnam. If that's what he wanted, why did that not happen, Jack?
Well, I think that this is something that historians have debated for decades now. What was his real intent? What was his real intent? What would he have done had he not been assassinated in November of 1963? But there's a significant amount of evidence that points in the direction of him wanting to get out of South Vietnam. At the time that he was murdered, we had 16,000 U.S. military personnel in South Vietnam. Within just a couple of years, that would escalate to 500,000 U.S. military personnel. So this was just the beginning of U.S. involvement in South Vietnam. And what Kennedy told his aides at the time was that if he was reelected in 1964, he intended to start pulling out. And he'd been in Congress when Mao took over China. And he had seen all the political damage that had done to the Truman administration. And he felt that if he tried to pull U.S. forces out of South Vietnam before he was reelected by a landslide in 64, he would face a tremendous backlash from conservatives and right-wingers in Congress. And that might damage his ability to get reelected in 64. So his plan was to wait until 64 and run up a huge vote majority, which Lyndon Johnson actually did against Barry Goldwater, and then use all that political capital to start pulling out people. Not long before he was killed in 63, Kennedy issued a statement saying that he was going to start withdrawing U.S. advisors, and he was going to get the first 1,000 of them out of the country by the end of that year. That was very controversial at the time. He took a certain amount of flack from that in the press. And after he was killed, that didn't happen because Lyndon Johnson became president and he started ramping up U.S. involvement in the war.
That reminds the listeners the title of your book. My guest is Jack Cheevers. Title of his book, Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. I'm going to ask you now to skip ahead to chapter 21, later in your book, when there's a very famous character. Oh, my gosh. We haven't talked about him yet, but what's the first name and at the start of your chapter one? Could you read some of that for us, Jack?
Sure. And to just give people a quick introduction to this, I think the person you're referring to, Nancy, is Henry Cabot Lodge, was the U.S. ambassador to South Vietnam at the time. So this chapter opens shortly after Kennedy was assassinated in November of 1963. And Lodge is on his way to Washington to make his first report to his new boss, who's Lyndon Johnson. Lodge packed his bags after the Honolulu conference and headed for Washington. He was staying at the elegant old St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco when Kennedy was shot. The ambassador was supposed to have lunch with JFK 2 days later at his new Virginia country house. He phoned George Bundy to see whether he was still needed in Washington. And Bundy, who, by the way, is Kennedy's national security assistant, Bundy told him to come ahead. The new president needed his counsel more than the old one. Lodge reached the Capitol on Saturday, November 23rd. A steady rain was falling and the White House was draped in black. He joined the throngs of people filing past JFK's casket as his remains lay in state in the East Room. Many of the mourners were weeping. The following afternoon, Lodge met Lyndon Johnson in the former vice president's office, a roomy, high-ceilinged suite in the executive office building adjacent to the White House. Johnson had just come from the Capitol, where he placed a wreath on JFK's bier in the rotunda. His eyes brimmed with tears, and his long, deeply lined Texas hound dog face was drawn. LBJ had met ZM during a whirlwind campaign-style visit to South Vietnam in May of 1961, overpraising him as, quote, the Churchill of Southeast Asia. He liked the Vietnamese leader enough to display an autographed photo of him in his office. Johnson thought the coup was a bad idea, although he hadn't vocally opposed it in the few Vietnam meetings he attended. Like JFK, he was repulsed by ZM's murder, as he later lamented to Democratic Senator Eugene McCarthy, quote, we killed him. We all got together and got a goddamn bunch of thugs and went in and assassinated him. Lee Harvey Oswald's bullets made Johnson, quote, the accidental president, and few men ever entered the Oval Office on shakier political legs. Though a towering figure in the Senate, the 55-year-old LBJ wasn't a skilled orator or the leader of a powerful political bloc. Liberals were uncomfortable with him as a Southerner, and the Eastern media often caricatured his countrified speech and mannerisms. Kennedy and his inner circle never fully accepted him, and he was locked in an increasingly bitter feud with Robert Kennedy, who regarded him as, quote, mean, bitter, vicious, an animal in many ways. Johnson wanted to drape himself with JFK's mantle as quickly as possible. Returning from Dallas on Air Force One after the assassination, he silently vowed to carry out his predecessor's programs and commitments, including in Vietnam. When he landed at Andrews Air Force Base, he was met by McNamara, Bundy, and George Ball. George Ball, by the way, is another undersecretary of state, who flew in the helicopter with him to the White House. Johnson told Kennedy's advisors they were the best men around. He needed them, and he wanted them all to stay in their jobs. He later asked every member of JFK's cabinet and White House staff to stick with him. Most did. For LBJ, an exodus of Kennedy people from the White House would have meant an exodus of Democratic Party confidence in him. As he later told his biographer, Doris Kearns, quote, I needed that White House staff. Without them, I would have lost my link to John Kennedy. And without that, I would have had absolutely no chance of gaining the support of the media or the Easterners or the intellectuals. And without that support, I would have had absolutely no chance of governing the country. Both Eisenhower and LBJ's longtime friend, Democratic Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, urged him to clean house and bring in his own people, but there was no time to hire an entirely new staff. More important, Johnson wanted to make it clear that he was a loyal trustee who could be depended on to carry forward Kennedy's domestic and foreign policies. As he declared before a joint session of Congress on November 27th, quote, let us continue.
This is my guest, Jack Cheevers. His book is Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. So LBJ gets caught up in the continuation, this descent in Vietnam. But there was kind of a dissent for LBJ himself. I found it rather shocking what he actually, people thought, gosh, is LBJ okay? Is he all there? And I didn't know anything about this, but later in your book, the label was paranoid disintegration. Did that surprise you, Chuck?
It did. It kind of shocked me, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I was shocked.
You're referring to two of his key aides, Richard Goodwin and Bill Moyers, who started thinking by the mid-60s as Johnson escalated U.S. involvement more and more, threw in, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of additional troops into Vietnam, that he was coming unraveled mentally and emotionally. And they actually consulted independently of one another. They consulted psychiatrists, and without talking about their patient, they described the symptoms and asked what the psychiatrist thought. And that's what the psychiatrist all agreed. And that was the conclusion that they reached, that he had become a paranoid personality and was basically coming apart at the seams. They never made that public. Richard Goodwin resigned shortly after that, but never talked about, at least in the immediate aftermath of his resignation, didn't talk about that at all.
He didn't say anything publicly about his boss's apparent mental fraying, but Goodwin did write later, the doctors said it was a textbook case of paranoid disintegration, the eruption of long-repressed irrationalities. I kind of hate to leave on that note, Jack, but there's so much more in your book that I think people will be fascinated by. Let me tell listeners again, the title of your book is Kennedy's Coup, A White House Plot, A Saigon Murder, and America's Descent into Vietnam. The author is Jack Cheevers. Thank you so much, Jack Cheevers.
Thank you, Nancy. It was a genuine pleasure.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Damaged goods. These lines spreading from my eyes, like the scrapings of some claw, are no decoration, no matter how much you love them. Damaged goods, my lawyer calls me, meaning debts I must lug everywhere, but this is too simple. I'd prefer to think these dings and scratches, the gray speckling my mustache, are not wounds, but history, like the smooth black on an old redwood trunk marking a forest fire or lightning, tree young at 200, green growing all around, young green growing at the tips every spring. At any rate, this heart is whole, unscarred, yours entirely. My bones may creak in the morning, but I am more good than damaged. Michelle Small.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.